Hey guys, how's it going? Well, all right then. That's great to pretend I heard. Turn this thing a little bit. All right. Yeah, it's my show, Scott Horton Show. I'm emailing a bunch of people at the last minute here. I got Jim Bovard. He's going to come on and talk about the Waco massacre and Eric Holder's role in obstructing justice in the case of the Waco massacre. That bastard. Holder, not Bovard. Somebody tweeted me this morning. They said, I understand now why they hate Bovard. And it was a link to Bovard at his best on Waco. So there you go. Jim Bovard, he's going to be on the show. Right now, I'm emailing Jeff Patterson. We had some kind of freaky time zone problem the other day. See if I can get Jeff Patterson back on. Also, I emailed Phil Giraldi because he wrote a great piece about American Likudnik billionaires trying to destroy the Iran nuclear deal. And then also I want to ask him about airstrikes in the state formerly known as Iraq, now the Islamic Caliphate. And there's somebody else too, I don't know. Man, I gotta email that guy back, and I got so much to do today. Yeah, I don't know. So there's a bunch of wars going on. Which wars do you guys want to talk about first? Join up the chat room, scotthorton.org/chat. It'll be not quite a democracy. Maybe it'll be a limited constitutional representative republic in the chat room today. You guys pick the order of war coverage. Should we talk about Ukraine? Should we talk about the Islamic State or the aftermath of the Gaza massacre? Can't really call that a war. A war, you see, is when two armies are fighting. As the late, great Bill Hicks explained 1,000 times over again. Hey, it's all right. Yes, he was reusing old material, but it really was not sinking in. People needed to hear that. A war is when at least there are two sides, not just one side slaughtering the other endlessly. Anyway, so there's the Gaza massacre. There's the Islamic State. Boy, there's a lot of massacres going on there, too. Coburn's right about those guys. They are like the Khmer Rouge. There's a, I mean, I don't know if it's true. Maybe it's Belgian babies on bayonets propaganda, but it didn't seem like it. This thing I read the other day about this one tribe in eastern Syria was declared to be an apostate tribe. And then the Islamic State murdered hundreds of them, rounded up and murdered hundreds of them, trying to eradicate this entire tribe from eastern Syria off of the map. And yeah, there's some devils. Boy, I'll tell you, it sure seems like that's all it takes for a casus belli in D.C. now. And this is why they always pretend that Noriega's Hitler, Saddam is Hitler, everybody's Hitler. Because, well, geez, you know, the lesson in World War II, we should have started it earlier. As soon as those Nazis came to power, we should have just declared war and went and killed their asses. That's the only thing to learn from World War II, actually. And so if everybody's Hitler, then we better start a war against them, huh? So that's the way it goes. And the thing is, these guys really are fanatical like Nazis, and they're murderers like Nazis, and they're racial chauvinists or sectarian chauvinists in a way that is reminiscent of the Nazis. But they don't have a Germany to rule. They don't have anything like a Germany to rule. They got the worst part of Iraq to rule in Syria. Some oil, but not much. And all of their prime benefactors are America's allies. So if Barack Obama would ever get around to telling the Kuwaitis, the Saudis, and the Qataris that he really, really means it, that he would like them to stop financing these guys, then they would have to. And would. But anyway, so yeah, they're like Nazis, but they're like Nazis ruling one county in Mississippi, you know? I mean, Missouri, maybe. Still not quite the same thing as a takeover of the whole country or an imminent threat to the U.S. Although Obama does seem to be trying to make it that way as best as he can. And there already are special forces on the ground there. So, the invasion's really already on. When he says no boots on the ground, there will not be any boots on the ground. What he means is they're already there. They're already there. Oh, special forces don't count as the 3rd Infantry Division. Well, they're not the 3rd Infantry Division. But still, they have boots. And they're within the borders of what used to be the borders of Iraq anyway. So, yeah, that counts if you ask me. And anyway, you know what? We're already near the first break. Let me go ahead and get my Rand Paul complaining out of my system right now before it ends up taking up the whole damn show. So I read this thing this morning. Drudge linked to it. I found it on Twitter. Follow Drudge on Twitter. And it was a Breitbart piece. I didn't see the original, but it was Rand Paul, his very best since 2008, I guess, when he started running, or 2009. He started running in 2009 for the 2010 election. In Kentucky, right? So anyway, he used to, when he would campaign for his dad, he used to talk about foreign policy in ways that showed some kind of, you know, pretty good understanding of what the hell was going on. Well, here he is just absolutely declaring war against Hillary Clinton. And I missed it. I guess it was on Meet the Press or one of these shows on Sunday where he absolutely and very specifically attacked Hillary Clinton for warmongering the war in Libya, which he not only said, led to the Benghazi attack quite correctly, and you know, for that matter, criticize her for not answering that phone call at 3 a.m. In fact, not answering it for 6 months straight when the covert operation in Benghazi was asking for better security there. And anyway, he didn't go into in this rant, but he has brought up before about guns being transferred from the Mujahideen in Libya, Gaddafi's weapons. And the CIA working on this project to move these weapons to the rebels in Syria, too. But he goes on and he attacks her for being for the Iraq war, the Libya war, and the intervention in Syria. She's only mad we didn't intervene even more in Syria against Assad. And he's pointing out these guys are bad guys, but all three of them are basically secular dictators. And when we overthrow them and regime change them, then what are we asking? What are we going to get to replace them? And, you know, a lot of this is the fault of da-da-da. And I'm reading this, and it's really good, man. And this is what I really would like to see is, you know, no point in sucking up to the neocons. They all hate Rand Paul anyway. Go ahead and attack Hillary Clinton for being a liberal internationalist interventionist. And push the line that a true conservative foreign policy is more bent on conserving than on just being a right-wing nationalist and acting out. And he says in there, good, he says, in Washington, D.C., they're so used to intervening in everything all the time that to be reluctant to be like that to them is isolationism. But to the people of the country, it's not. And he's distancing himself from his father, which, you know, if he meant what he said, really, it would be acceptable for him to define realism as being realistic enough to stay out of this, being realistic enough to be libertarian on foreign policy. You know, that would be fine. He's a bit more wishy-washy on intervention and in numerous cases. But, you know, when he's attacking Hillary Clinton, his presumed opponent, or, you know, if he could ever get the nomination for the upcoming presidential campaign, when he takes her on like this, attacking her like this, it's the greatest thing, and it drives all the neocons. Jennifer Rubin of the Washington Post is already, her brain is exploding, and it makes a great way, as he himself points out, a great way to, you know, get through to the American people about what's really going on here and who stands for what and why and all of that. And then at the end, he says he's for airstrikes on ISIS. At the end, he goes on and says the difference between him and Obama on this is he would go to Congress and ask them for authorization to launch an air war against the Islamic State. Oh, man. Come on, Rand Paul. Don't you see? When you're being right, you're right, and you don't have to double back like that and be wrong just to be right. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck.
Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
I guess we could just sit here and watch The Simpsons, except it's all later episodes now, and most of them are just no damn good. I mean, one thing that's good about them is I haven't seen them before, so it's kind of cool seeing new Simpsons is that, oh, I've never seen this one, you know? But they're really no good. In fact, I'm kind of thinking that, you know, maybe some of the people who are the writers and producers of The Simpsons now, maybe they watched some of the earlier seasons during this marathon and have been kind of inspired to like, oh yeah, I remember back when The Simpsons was awesome and hateful, you know, very subtly, and was cool. It's sort of like my probably ridiculous hopes for Star Wars 7, right? That like, we'll just pretend the prequels never happened, and we'll make all the new ones as much like The Empire Strikes Back as we can, you know? No Gungans. I don't know. I still love The Simpsons, though. Even the ones that suck, I still... What am I going to do? All right, well, so listen, I got a complaint today about this piece. Well, I got to complain about a lot of things, especially the war in Ukraine. I got to get to that. But you know what? I don't know. I picked this first. For Kentucky Town That Gave Much, New Worries Over Iraq. It's by Chris Adams at McClatchy. And I ain't mad at him, and you know, I ain't even mad at any of the people in here who get everything just so wrong, because you know what? I understand. But they're just so wrong. The entire thrust of this. And you know what? I mean, maybe you couldn't find anybody in all this whole town who knew better. This is what the people of this Kentucky town have to say about their losses, their family losses in the last Iraq war and what's going on there now. And they're all just parroting these stupid Republican talking points about, well, we just should have never left. And they're completely contradicting themselves. If they won the war, then how come everything fell apart as soon as they left? Who in the hell defined winning as having to stay there forever to prevent all of the war's consequences from playing out? Forever. That doesn't make any sense at all, does it? Of course it doesn't. But they even invoke the Vietnam stab in the back theory to explain what happened here. Yeah, it's just like during Vietnam, where everything was great until the media and the Congress and the liberals and the damn Democrats ruined it. See, they're doing what they did in Vietnam. We've got the might, but politics is what's killing everything. So that's about, you know, as good as you can get. But you see exactly what he means there. I honestly feel we pulled out of Iraq too soon. It was something done to gain political favor. All the loss we had, all the guys who made tremendous sacrifices. And for what? Pulling out was the worst mistake we could have ever made. But you see what none of these quotes have. None of them. Including these guys whose family members died in the thing. What's not displayed? What's the dog that didn't bark in any of these statements? An understanding of what the mission was at all. What had been accomplished and what hadn't. They're speaking in such generalities they could be kindergarten teachers. Well, you see, kids, if only America, which is walking stability when it explodes things, when they get a million people killed, only that kind of peace can only be kept if we stay everywhere we invade forever and ever with no exceptions. And if the people who we succeed in putting in power tell us to go, then we should go to war against them so that we can stay, so that we can keep that stability going. There is no display of comprehension of the situation in Iraq at all in here anywhere. Well, we had the good Sunnis turn against the bad Sunnis for a while, but now the bad Sunnis are back because we left. Okay, that would be stupid, but at least it would have, like, a beginning, a middle, and an end. You know? At least it would have some kind of reference to the actual country of Iraq as anything other than this abstraction. And nowhere in here is a recognition that if they can't think of what the war is for, if they're asking rhetorical questions, and for what, and they can't answer it, for what? And maybe it was wrong in the first place. Maybe their mistake was believing in it and sending their son off to go and kill and perhaps die in it, when they, after all this time, can't think of a single thing that was a reason for doing it. Saddam Hussein, the guy in the olive green, the guy who might as well have been a Frenchman, he was such an atheist and a secular military fascist dictator. Gotta go get rid of him, huh? What are you, stupid? Oh, but he committed all these horrible crimes against his own people. Yeah, when he was under the authority of your number one hero of all time, Ronald Reagan, he committed the worst of his atrocities. Never mind peace or non-interventionism or anything else. If you were an American war hawk, but you loved America and didn't put Israel first, or put, you know, whatever slogan they trained you to chant first, then you would have recognized that the first thing that George W. Bush should have done was sent Donald Rumsfeld to go over there and shake hands with Saddam Hussein again and tell him, you keep your chin shaved and you kill Al-Qaeda guys and we'll let you live, pal. You and your friend Assad. Your job is killing jihadis. Don't step out of line. And then it could have been America. Could have created an axis of evil with Syria and Iraq and Iran and even the Taliban or whoever they put in power in Afghanistan to keep Al-Qaeda bottled up on the Durand line in Pakistan, on the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan. And there they would have met their demise within, what, a couple of years. But no, instead, what did Bush do? With the support of every single person quoted in this McClatchy article, Bush went and got rid of the bottle cap. And he brought bin Laden's men, who multiplied by the thousands, to an entire massive, almost Texas-sized, lawless territory of Wild West Sunni jihadi stan from 2003 through 2000 right now. Oh, but the problem is that we ever left? Are you sure? Hey, does it matter at all what actually happened? Or just America is a country of tiny little grown-up children who couldn't possibly have been wrong, have betrayed their own son, has supported the dumbest foreign policy, the worst strategic disaster in American history. I bet it probably is Iran's fault, huh? Maybe nuke them next.
Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com.
All right, kids, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And I got my good friend Jim Bovard on the line. He's from the Future Freedom Foundation and Amazon.com, where he actually wrote most of the books that they sell there. Let's see. I can do this pretty well. I might miss one or two, but there's the free trade fraud. No, the fair trade fraud.
and the farm fiasco, feeling your pain. See the F's there. FFF, huh? Feeling your pain. Freedom in Chains. And what are some more Clinton era ones? Why Scott Hates Bill Clinton So Much. Something like that. And then from the Bush years, of course, there's Terrorism and Tyranny, The Bush Betrayal, Attention Deficit Democracy, which is still on the Scott Horton number one bestseller list of all time. It's so damn good. And then the latest is his memoir, which is called Public Policy Hooligan, and is a hell of a lot of fun, too. So there's all Bovard's books. You should read all of them because they're great. Even the ones from back in the 90s, you know, for historical purposes. Kind of like today's interview. Welcome back to the show, Jim. How are you doing?
Doing good. Thanks for having me on, Scott.
Very happy to have you here. And, yeah, I got you on to talk about history. It seems like only yesterday to me, but I guess it could be back before some listeners were born here on the show now. And it's at jimbovard.com, Eric Holder and the Waco cover-up. And you had this piece in the Washington Times about Eric Holder and how, this is a whole other interview, it could be, about how back when he was at the Justice Department in the 90s, he was in charge of accountability for killer cops in Washington, D.C., and never did do his dang job. But then in this other article... and you can clarify that in a second. But then this other article, you talk about how you referenced in there his role in helping to cover up the Waco massacre, which is of special interest to me and always will be. So that's why you decided to go digging through your archives and pull up this old Spectator article about Waco, which does include some of Eric Holder's role in the cover-up, even the cover-up of the cover-up there. And so let's talk about that in just a second. But first of all, clarify what I got wrong about that. The first Washington Times piece there.
Eric Holder was U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia from 1993 to 1997. Mm-hmm. As such, he was responsible for policing the local police because it's the strange setup they have in D.C. that the U.S. Attorney is like the ultimate person that files lawsuits against government misconduct within the district. And during the time he was U.S. Attorney, the D.C. police had the highest rate of shooting civilians in the country, and Eric Holder never noticed. And not only that, but there were a number of cases where the D.C. police shot black teenagers and then basically lied about it. And Eric Holder just kind of, didn't really raise a fuss about that. And a lot of the cases, it didn't even notice. Something that the D.C. police were famous for was shooting in the cars of unarmed drivers. Doing that at a rate 20 times higher than the New York City police, Eric Holder never noticed.
Amazing. And you know what? See, we can't change the subject back to Waco for another couple of minutes here because, of course, this is the guy who is being sent out to make sure that everything is A-OK in Ferguson because the Bill of Rights is inside out in America now. It's now a mandate to the national government instead of a list of restrictions against them. And so if something's wrong on your local level, there's only one way to look, and that's up to your boss's boss and hope that DOJ will come and protect your civil rights and whatever kind of nonsense, which, I mean, in some cases, important stuff happens there and people are protected, but it seems like a kind of back-asswards way of approaching things to me. But then especially, I don't know if you saw this, but I need your comment on, even if you didn't see it, I'm telling you, it's true that a whole bunch of progressive and liberal groups have written an open letter to Barack Obama and to the Congress calling for the establishment of a police czar at the Department of Justice who will oversee the implementation of the normalization of police methods across the country. And it sounds like real, nationalization beyond what even the Department of Homeland Security ever was.
Well, it's bizarre at several levels. Just step back to the Ferguson case. Eric Holder made a big deal last Thursday of visiting the parents of the 18-year-old guy that had been killed by the local cop there. During the time that he was U.S. attorney in D.C., he never bothered visiting the parents of teenagers who were unjustifiably killed by the D.C. police. On the national police czar stuff, you know, I'm starting to wonder if liberals don't have a sharp learning curve. This and something which is kind of amusing is to see a number of the members of the Black Caucus, Congressional Black Caucus, in the forefront pushing for this because most of them, except for John Conyers of Michigan, have paid very little attention to misgovernment or misdeeds by the FBI, except when the FBI is prosecuting corrupt congressmen.
Right.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm sympathetic, you know, because I guess I had all liberal teachers when I was a kid. My parents are you know, moderate to liberal types, and so I was raised
You're
at least
Texas,
to...
Texas, though. You know, Texas,
yeah,
liberal is different.
Well, yeah, that might be true, although my parents are transplants, so my dad was like a Bobby Kennedy guy. But so the way I was raised was to understand that Abraham Lincoln, and then 100 years later, LBJ, freed the blacks, finally. Lincoln did half a job, and then LBJ came and finished it, and the people of the states were never going to treat black people fairly until the national government said, if you don't, we're going to put you in prison. And finally, then they had to begin. And so, you know, poor and minorities and women's rights, a lot of things, a lot of even, you know, call it progressive or libertarian type virtues in due process on the part of people in the states and subject to state jurisdiction is because of federal civil rights legislation and court rulings, you know, the Miranda ruling and these kinds of things. And so it can be very hard for people to break out of that narrative and say, yeah, but in this case, it's clearly the federal war on drugs and the federal welfare for Lockheed program of giving all these excess, you know, surplus weapons to the locals that have got us into this situation. So maybe Lincoln and LBJ were great if you were poor and black and powerless, but that doesn't mean that, you know, Eric Holder and Barack Obama are the solution to this crisis that they have helped to cause right now.
Well, the fundamental problem with a lot of the stuff that was done in the 1960s was it was a vast expansion of government power, and in the following decades, there was a vast increase in the number of criminal statutes. So the government had far more pretext to throw people in jail. And it's sad that the civil rights narrative stops before the vast increase in the federal prison population, federal and state prison population, which has ravaged, you know, especially low-income groups in this country, and had far more adverse effect than some of the things that the feds were targeting as problems in the 1960s.
Yeah. Well, you know, of course, as us libertarians have been saying all along, it's the war on drugs is responsible for as much of it as anything. And there has been a lot of really strong support among, for example, black Protestant ministers and prominent people in black communities across America for harsh drug laws under that same old mistaken statist theory that, well, if we don't want them carrying around drugs in their pocket, give them a real stiff sentence for it, but without really thinking through the consequences, where now there are more blacks in prison than there ever were slaves in the South.
Well, and I'm not sure about those numbers, but take a step back.
Well, that's what Michelle Alexander says in her book.
Okay, well, Eric Holder is now talking about how he wants to roll back some of his mandatory minimums, but when he was U.S. attorney for D.C. in the mid-1990s, he was urging the D.C. City Council to enact a mandatory minimum law in which people caught with 1.5 ounces of marijuana could get sent to prison for up to 5 years. Mm-hmm. 1.5 ounces, make an automatic presumption the person is a dealer, throw them in prison up to 5 years. Makes no sense at all. There were some speeches he was giving. He was complaining about violence tied to the marijuana exchanges in Southeast D.C. in a rougher part of town. It never occurred to him that, you know, if you made it legal, people wouldn't be shooting each other for it.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Now hold it right there. I got an anecdote along those lines, especially regarding D.C. Jim Bovard, the great Jim Bovard, fff.org, jimbovard.com. Back in a sec.
Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. On the line is Jim Bovard, my good friend and the author of a hell of a lot of great books. The latest is Public Policy Hooligan. Great memoir there. And he's one of the few people who was good on the Waco massacre back in real time. It was so few and far between, and I actually didn't even really know about the libertarian movement and Jim and his work on Waco back then. The only people I knew who cared about it at all were more like right-wing populist patriot types. Everybody else seemed to just completely give the government a free pass, and then especially after the Oklahoma City bombing, for years there, it was the perfect inoculation. You couldn't say a word about Waco without people trying to accuse you of being in on it with McVeigh somehow, as though, you know, the Branch Davidians somehow had gone forward in time and done the Oklahoma bombing to justify what had happened to them back 2 years before, some ridiculous thing. But anyway,
it was a time machine.
Yeah, yeah, and the whole thing's crazy. And then, of course, you know me, there's a gigantic, I think one of the biggest scandals in American history is the cover-up of the Oklahoma bombing and how all McVeigh's friends were all flip states witnesses and undercover informants and worse, and so the government was compromised. It was Bob Ricks, the spokesman for the FBI during the Waco massacre, was the head of the Tulsa office who shut down the ATF's investigation into the Nazis that later did the bombing. It's all his responsibility. Same group of criminals again. And there's one that I don't know if you, I guess you've never really gotten into that one before, Jim. I sure would love to read what you had to write about it if you did. But anyway, when it comes to Waco, this is a huge part of my political education. I was 15 at the time. I'd already learned about Ronald Reagan. Mr. Drug War was also the hemisphere's greatest cocaine dealer. And so, and I was always raised to disrespect Republicans anyway, which was nice. My whole childhood, I wasn't loyal to the government. But then as soon as Clinton got in power, he burnt the Branch Davidians to death and lied about it and got away with it. And I knew that there was nothing better on the Democratic side than you get from these evil Republicans. And so I never did have to be a Republican or a Democrat, a liberal or a conservative. My whole life, I've basically been a libertarian abolitionist of these scumbag murderers. So anyway, that's just my preface for introducing Bovard's great work on the Oklahoma bombing. He must have written a book worth of essays, investigative opinion pieces, as they are, as he specializes in, for The Spectator, for The Washington Times, et cetera, et cetera. And the one that you republished here on your blog today, Jim, ran in The American Spectator in the year 2000, and it's about really the last cover-up of the Waco massacre, the Danforth report, and Eric Holder's role in the compiling and the so-called investigation behind that report. Please do tell, sir.
Well, Eric Holder was the point person back in a key issue after the Waco fireball was the feds were claiming they never had any responsibility for that at all, and the feds had claimed it was complete slander to say that they had fired pyrotechnic rounds into the Waco building before it burst into flames. Janet Reno testified that in 1995 in Congress, and that was part of her her success in crushing a wave of skepticism on it back then. But thanks to Mike McNulty, a very dogged investigator, he went in through the rubble and found a number of pyrotechnic rounds the FBI had fired on during the final day assault. And that basically destroyed Janet Reno's credibility in 1999. There were a lot of other details that came up that showed the feds had been lying up and down and back and forth on this. Janet Reno got so upset that she sent, if memory serves, she sent U.S. Marshals to go over and search FBI headquarters. I might be wrong in that detail, but it's close if it's not dead spot on accurate. And so in order to handle the controversy, Janet Reno appointed John former Senator John Danforth to supposedly lead an independent investigation. Danforth is known as Pious Jack because he was one of the most sanctimonious members of the U.S. Senate, which is not an easy standard to achieve. But John Danforth ran this investigation being managed basically like a puppet, I would guess, by Eric Holder. And Danforth basically brushed all the evidence under the rug and came up with one excuse after another to justify what the FBI had did, and then rushed to issue his final report before he was done investigating. And he wanted to do that because he was under consideration to be George W. Bush's vice presidential nominee in the summer of 2000. But it was such a bizarre report, and it was captured. The thing that captured it best was the comment that Danforth made that when he issued their final report. He said, as I flipped through my page here. The thing he said is that he hoped his report would begin the process of restoring the faith of the people in their government and the faith of the government in the people. And this was something that Eric Holder echoed when at the time report came out, to the effect that Holder said that he hoped that that Holder said that we join Senator Danforth in wishing that this report begins the process of restoring the faith of the people in their government. And the whole key to that meant the whole key to restoring faith was to sweep the damning evidence under the rug and deny it existed, and find one contorted rationale after another for exonerating the government, even if the government had admitted it had made false statements or had done grave misconduct.
Yep. And, you know, maybe this is a product of my era as well, Jim, that I was raised after Watergate to understand that it's always the cover-up that gets you. Not that the cover-up is necessarily worse, but it just entails so many more crimes to try to get away with the original one that now you're basically just screwed. And then, so, that always seemed, it was so transparent at the time what was going on with this Danforth report, as well as all the other government reports exonerating themselves that had taken place before that. And that's the part that just enraged me so much, even as much as the murders themselves. That how in the world are you going to set up a test where you spray down all of the dirt on the ground with water to keep all the dust down, you use flash suppression ammo, and extended length barrels, and then you tell me that, oh no, the flashes don't match the FLIR. Well, yeah, but that's because you're lying. I mean, what in the hell is this?
Yeah, to take a step back, you were saying that the cover-up's always worse than the crime. Having worked as a journalist investigating a lot of these government abuses over the last several decades, most government cover-ups succeed. And it's very rare for a government agency to simply implode because of all its lies finally coming out. It looked for a while in 1995 and 1999 that that might happen to the FBI with its all its falsehoods on Waco, but they managed to patch up the ship and, you know, spin it and get people like John Danforth and Eric Holder to cover up the abuses. And they march merrily on. It's hard to think of a cover-up in which the perpetrators got what they deserved.
Yeah, it's really crazy. And, you know, there's the whole thing about it, too, that, I mean, and I think this is a big part of why they get away with it, too, is because the American people were in on it. It's just like accountability for the Iraq War. Come on, guys, let's get them. And the American people are more than happy to form the lynch mob, to go in there and do the killing, to be the cheerleading squad for the actual Delta Force trigger pullers. And so they don't want accountability for themselves either, even in their own minds. And so they rather just go on.
Yeah, I would, you know, there certainly were a lot of people who felt that way. There were also a lot of individuals who smelled something dirty from the very start.
Well, yeah.
And they were speaking out or trying to speak out. It was challenging to speak out then because there wasn't an internet, and it wasn't like the mainstream media is going to be publishing articles about, like, gee whiz, the FBI looks like the FBI is bringing in tanks and the FBI is ramping things up, and they're playing all these very loud tapes of rabbits being slaughtered. Gee, I wonder if the FBI is out of their bloody minds.
Right. Yeah, no, I said that day, I said, oh, come on, they're not showing the back of the building. Why do you think they're only showing one side of the building?
Wow.
It's because in the back they're killing those people. You're telling me these people set their own children on fire is more plausible than a bunch of militarized cops machine gun them to death and set their house on fire? Give me a break. And again, I was 15, but not stupid.
Well, and plus you were in Texas.
Well, and I didn't have bloodlust for those people. And in fact, I was really, you know, kind of taken aback by the bloodlust of the neighborhood ladies. I've told the story before about working at the grocery store, and all the white ladies of Northwest Austin wanted those people dead. I mean, the capital crime was interrupting their game shows and their love stories, and they wanted an end to this damn thing yesterday. 51-day siege? Are you kidding me? Kill them all.
Well, it was interesting that there was almost no criticism on Capitol Hill when this went down. Jack Brooks, I think, was the Texas congressman who said, well, you know, burn him to death, it serves him right, or something like
right.
that. John Conyers, Michigan congressman, to his credit, did challenge Janet Reno on this. And if memory serves, Janet Reno started to cry during a hearing. But it's appalling that there was not far greater backlash. But, you know, once again, this is a government cover-up that largely succeeded.
Yeah, there you go. JimBovard.com for this great article. Eric Holder and the Waco cover-up. Thanks so much, Jim.
Hey, thanks, Scott.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. So you made a little bit of money in this horrid economy, only to find that the Fed has more or less outlawed saving. So into the treacherous waters of the stock market bubble you go. But how to make a little money without too much risk of losing it all? Check out WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who opens a very real window into his main account, updating his subscribers on the facts of and the reasoning behind all his market moves. Follow along on paper or with real money and see what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.
Me. How are you guys doing? All right. Well, all right. I already asked you that. Sorry. I'm Scott. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Join up the chat room if you want. Hey, chat room, everybody. ScottHorton.org/chat. ScottHorton.org/chat. For the chat room. This is the part of the show where I say thank you very much to everybody who's been donating lately. You too can donate, sign up for a monthly subscription, or subscribe all at once. If you'd like to do that, just go to scottwarden.org/donate. It's got all the links for you there. If you donate $100 or more, I'll send you a 1 ounce commodity disc. It's a QR code commodity disc. You scan the back, and it tells you the instant spot price. This is, I believe, the greatest invention in the history of humanity. Pretty sure. Maybe antibiotics, but other than that. So anyway, they're really great. And well, they keep printing money, and you know what that means for the price of silver over the long haul. All right. Yes, and thank you very much to all the show's sponsors. And that is the Wall Street Window and War State. Both of those, Michael Swanson, first and foremost. Thank you very much, sir. Also, Phil Giraldi at the Council for the National Interest, who coincidentally will be on the show today to talk about some of the things that he wrote. As you well know, I've been interviewing Phil Giraldi since long before his institution started sponsoring the show, so it's not really a conflict of interest. I want to know what he has to say about this stuff. And you do, too. So, then there's the Future Freedom Foundation. They don't have to bribe me to interview Bovard or anybody else either. No conflict of interest there, just friendly support. A little bit of support there from the Future Freedom Foundation. Of course, Roberts and Roberts Brokerage, Inc., they're one of the newest sponsors, and their gold dealers are, you know, brokerage folk who help you buy precious metals when you're wanting to buy precious metals. And they're at rrbi.co, and they do great work, and they've got a lot of great people vouching for them, and they've been in business since the 70s, and hell yeah, for them. They're great, too, and really appreciate their support. And then, of course, Darren's Coffee Company. Oh, my God. There has never been worse Folgers than after you've been drinking Darren's coffee for a few weeks, and then you got to switch back to Folgers, which maybe I shouldn't say that for the ad because maybe that's not a good thing to say for the ad, but it's really good. And I'm not into fancy flavors and a bunch of, you know, girly coffee, but it's just there's the Iron Roast and the Ethiopia and whatever. Different flavors of black coffee, basically. And it's good stuff. I guess if you want to put a bunch of crap in it, you can do that too. But anyway, darrenscoffee.com, they've been real great about helping support the show as well. I sure appreciate that. And I hope you guys will appreciate that and go appreciate them. And read The War State, for crying out loud. And also buy Liberty stickers if you hate the government, but you don't have a radio show. Maybe you want to tell the people in traffic how much you hate the government. Just go to libertystickers.com. I already thought of a slogan for every possible kind of government hatred you could have, I'm pretty sure. Just go and scan through. At least you'll get a laugh. I might find something you want there at libertystickers.com. And then what am I leaving out here? Braswell wrote a book, Pizza Noir. I'm still not done with the damn thing. I'm so bad about reading books. But I'm taking tomorrow off. I'm taking a four-day weekend. I'm taking Monday off, too, god dang it. And I'm taking 4 days, and I am reading. I have so much stuff that I absolutely have to get read, and that's what I'm going to do. God dang it. First and foremost will be Pizza Noir by... I've already read more than half of it. I'll finish that up. That's Chris Braswell's book. And then, who am I leaving out? I got Darren and FFF and CNI, Wall Street Window, Liberty Stickers, 10th Amendment Center, kind of former sponsors, maybe again someday in the future. Hope so. I still support that Off Now project because it's a good one. And then, okay, yeah. And by the way, Oh, yeah. So, again, thank you very much to all those guys and to all you listeners. Patronize my sponsors, would you? You want to support the Future Freedom Foundation and the Council for the National Interest anyway. Well, so now here's me telling you, go and do that, please, would you? Go subscribe to Wall Street Window and learn why it is that Mike Swanson keeps making money while everybody else keeps losing it at wallstreetwindow.com. And read his book, The War State, about how even Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all fought to limit the national security state and lost after World War II. You'll dig it, man. That's good stuff. So, yeah, that's me talking about my sponsors. And again, if you want to help support the show, it's scottwarden.org/donate. And, you know, if you do a monthly subscription, just $8, that's basically $100 a year. That'd be very kind of you if you just did a monthly subscription for $8. If I could get a whole bunch of you to subscribe for $8, then that would be, I don't know, some kind of X amount of money. It'd be really helpful. So, you know, and in fact, I've had recently people have subscribed for $3 donations and $5 donations and $8 donations, and those are awesome. I appreciate that so much. And I'm not trying to discourage people from signing up for $20 monthly ones, which are also great. But, you know, don't think I don't appreciate the $3 a month. If, you know, it's all about multiplication. We all went to junior high, at least, and understand how quite a few people donating $3 a month is three times quite a few, and that could end up being quite a bit. So there you go. Appreciate that very much, all of you guys. All right, now back to me complaining about stuff, which is why you want to support the show. Can you imagine going through right now this time with a reinvasion of Iraq going on? All this conflict with Russia right on their border, America picking a fight in Ukraine. The end of the two-state solution and the beginning of some kind of horrible purgatory there for Israel-Palestine that nobody knows what the hell exactly is going to happen there and all this, and then you don't have this show? Is that what you want? Of course not. Okay, good. All right, now, let me talk about Waco for just another minute. First of all, just type in Jim Bovard Waco, James Bovard Waco, and read his articles. He's written a lot of articles, and he's good on the facts. And he sticks to them very well. And you can learn a hell of a lot about it right there. But the very best sources are what he mentioned. Mike McNulty's films, Waco, The Rules of Engagement, and Waco, A New Revelation. You can find both of them at my website, scotthorton.org/documentaries. That's pretty easy. scotthorton.org/documentaries. And I didn't make any of those. I just have a little collection of open source documentaries, mostly YouTube and, you know, other embedded video type things of documentaries that I'd like you to see. That's all. And both of those are in there. And it's Waco, A New Revelation that shows the much higher quality footage than in the first one, where you can see the FBI and or JSOC Combat Applications Group, Team B, Delta Force guys get out of the tanks and fire their machine guns at the back of the house. And there's just no mistake in it. There's no lie that can be told that'll change your mind what you see when you see that footage. It's the FBI's own plane shooting forward-looking infrared in circles flying overhead. And there are the federal government's men getting out of the tanks and machine gunning the people to death as the house is burning down, before and during. As well as all the evidence about the pyrotechnic rounds that were found at the origins of the fire and all the rest. If you want to read the greatest book about Waco, you can read the entire thing online. It's carolmoore.net, I believe, is her website. But if you just search for the Davidian Massacre, The Davidian Massacre by Carol Moore, that, at least at one time, and I think probably still, is the single best book. Not that it covers every single thing in every other book about Waco, but that is the single best book about what the federal government did to those people. If you want to read that, it's just maddening. It's just, how could anybody be a Republican or a Democrat again after that? Are you kidding me? How could anybody respect a cop? Or the pretension of their rule of law. Ha! Courts. Ha! Courts. What a joke. That's like a something out of a fairy story that you read to little kids. Yeah, there's this whole complete separate branch of government that makes its bones whooping ass on the other two all day. And then the tooth fairy comes and gives you a quarter, and your tooth falls out.
The military-industrial complex. The disastrous rise of misplaced power.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State, by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot, though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one. But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today. Corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The War State by Michael Swanson. Available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com. Or just click the logo in the right-hand margin at ScottHorton.org.
We should take nothing for granted.
All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Hey, Phil Giraldi's going to be back on the show. He wrote this thing about right-wing billionaire Jews in America who support horrible politicians to be horrible on Iran. And just how distorted our political process is because of how hard they work to screw up everything. And so that'll be interesting. It's at uns.com, that article. And then also I want to ask him all about the Islamic State and who's bombing what and this and that.
Blame Chris. I refuse to accept responsibility. My friend Chris on Twitter is, going back and forth here about Rand Paul, and so now I got to talk about him some more. I admit I'm kind of obsessed with the subject of Rand Paul, if not, you know, the person who I can barely stand to hear his voice. It's just, But the whole concept of Ron Paul's son in the Senate is a very intriguing thing. And, I'm not the perfect Paulian. He has his discrepancies with my point of view and vice versa, no doubt about that. But, I can't imagine a situation that I've heard of yet where Rand really needs to back down from what his dad said, certainly on issues of foreign policy. And I think here's what's coming right now, okay? Rand Paul has just basically called Hillary Clinton George W. Bush and said, you know, here, this lady, her judgment is so bad on the last three or four wars here that it can't be up to her. Oh my God, that is so beautiful. That's like the most wonderful thing ever. I'm reading this, the quotes of the Drudge Report, the Drudge linked to Breitbart. I'm reading the quotes out of this article, and I'm saying, oh my God, this is the greatest day of Rand Paul's life. This may be the greatest day in American politics in 100 years. And this is really something. Two presidential front runners, admittedly a little bit, a year and a half out from the election, but still, two presidential frontrunners already fighting like this, and the Republican is the Ron Paulian peacenik, and Hillary Clinton is Goldwater's girl, the right-wing nationalist imperialist expansionist, and who has been absolutely horrible on everything. And so here, what do we have here, right? What we have here is, and never mind the part for the moment, for argument's sake, never mind that Rand is actually bad on bombing ISIS right now, which is just, God dang it, man, what is it? A boy ain't right. But anyway, never mind that for the moment. But still, back on the larger point of he's taking the dove position and criticizing her for being a hawk and pointing to the catastrophe of her will being played out and the consequences from that. Now, what could happen here? Obviously, there's a huge fight. He's got to win a fight on his right inside the Republican Party. And he's got to successfully basically conflate them with her and discredit them altogether and claim the mantle of the American people who want peace. And so to do that, he's got to be really good on the facts. To do that, he's got to care enough to
to really work hard, to really know, to really understand. So that when he has to fight about this, he can always get the last word, always. They got, you and I both know, the war party, they've had, better than a decade of practicing all their talking points, and mostly unopposed. So somebody like Rand, with facts on his side, and with a real self-education as to who all has been doing what here since the dawn of the Terror War, he could really kick their ass. He could really put the entire establishment, I mean, not really necessarily put them out, he couldn't do that, but he could make them have to rush to get in front of our parade. He could do that. He's got enormous potential energy at his fingertips right now. And the worst thing he can do is, first of all, water it down with stuff like, well, I'm four strikes on ISIS right now. I just think Congress ought to declare it first. Well, you know, are you sure? What's your argument for that? Is it really a good one? I mean, the sixth or seventh grader in all of us would like to fly an F-16 and drop JDAMs on these guys as they're driving in their giant Toyota convoys down the highway. Thanks, Obama, for the Toyotas. Thank you, Public Radio International, for showing that. But what's going to benefit from that? What's that actually going to accomplish? So a horrible deviation there. But the real point is, okay, for example, he brings up Libya, and he's brought up before the CIA gun running from Libya to Syria. But you can tell he's only kind of scratching the surface because he's not really immersed himself in it. Well, what if he really has to fight with Hillary Clinton, who was the Secretary of State at the time, and at least, knows what she wants to say about that? They've tangled about it before. But is he going to really, before he said, well, there were reports. How about, nah, come on, the London Times was there as the ship was being unloaded, and Nusra and the Muslim Brotherhood were fighting over who's getting the goods. So don't come at me like you don't know what I'm talking about, lady, when it was in the biggest paper in England. Right? That's how someone who's actually educated in this would do it, would drop the actual source and say, so, what about that? Instead of just, well, I heard somewhere, and then she's not committed to refuting you heard somewhere. Same thing with a pretty complicated story about who's been backing who in ISIS and to what effect, and cooperating with who, to what degree, and at what times, and why. It's a huge mess. That's something that he is, by default, correct on. He understands the black and white that, hey, why are we supporting rebels against Assad when Assad is the secular Ba'athist dictator who's the only one with the capability of keeping jihadists down? And when, as he said, we've created kind of a power vacuum that ISIS has filled and all of that. Well, that much is true, but when it really comes to, American involvement and who's been backing the different groups for how long and that kind of thing, I'm just saying he better be prepared, because the war party, they have their entire line of total nonsense memorized about, oh, if only we had supported the Free Syrian Army more, then they would have been able to limit the power of ISIS then and this and that. And anyway, if you went up against Ron Paul about any of this stuff, he can cite you chapter and verse. And the reason why is because Ron Paul is obsessed with foreign policy. He's interested in it. He reads about it day in and day out. And he knows where he stands on everything before he even begins. He's against it. And I've interviewed Ron Paul for years and years now. And, even when he was running for president, I was interviewing him mostly for antiwar.com, which is a nonprofit. So I couldn't interview him about the campaign. So be in the middle of a campaign for president, and I'd interview him, hey, let's talk about what's going on in the Korean Peninsula. And he's like, okay, and talks for 10 minutes about what's going on in the Korean Peninsula. He really knows, because he really cares. And I think Rand could be that good if he would try, if he would make the commitment. And he's going to have to be that good if he's going to win these fights against his own right and the entire Democratic Party, too.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my goddamn show here. I don't know. Everybody's claiming that the Russians have crossed the border, except the Russians are claiming, no, they're volunteers. Like Mao's guys in the Korean War? Is that it? I don't know. Jason Ditz is going to be on the show here in a little while. He knows. He's going to fill us in what's going on in Ukraine there. Could it be that after all this time, the Russian military has actually crossed the border? It means to occupy the two easternmost, secessionist-most provinces there? Or more? Sure. It's a good thing history began just now. Otherwise, we'd have to figure out how this happened. All we need to know now is, Russia bad. What are we going to do about it? I see Jennifer Rubin on Twitter mocking Obama. Russia invades Ukraine. Obama concerned. Oh, he's concerned, is he? Wonder what Jennifer Rubin would have him do. Wonder what the neocons would have him do now that their bluff has been called, if it in fact has been called by the Russians on this. Well, luckily, it's not up to them. It's funny, I got an email from a friend talking about how, the way he said it was great. He said, the greatest deceit the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he was George W. Bush, not Barack Obama. So I says, haha, yeah, you're right. Honestly, for me, no, I still hate Bush more. And he says, yeah, but the betrayal of Obama. And so I says, oh, see, I never felt that betrayal by Obama because I hated him the first time I ever heard his name. Oh, he's a prominent Democrat and TV wants me to like him, huh? Well, I hate him. He must, by default, be absolutely horrible. And then he always was. From 2007 on, he painted Bush as incompetent for not invading Afghanistan and Pakistan, both full scale and surging on in there and cleaning out the Taliban once and for all, like he would later on go on to do, right? Of course he's the devil. Of course he's George Bush in blackface. What did you think this is, a democracy or some kind of fairy tale where even you can grow up to be president one day, Timmy, and this kind of crap? Are you kidding me? He's just Hillary Clinton in drag is all he is. Everybody knew that all along. But anyway, no, I guess some people didn't, and some people really did feel betrayed. But honestly, I'll be honest with you, I think he could have been worse. Well, we're going to talk with Phil Giraldi about the Iran nuclear deal. It seems to me like Obama wants to do it, even if everybody in his administration is basically a traitor trying to undermine him. Seems like he really wants this nuclear deal with Iran. And man, I sure support that like crazy. And actually, when it comes to the war in Syria, yes, he has absolutely, undeniably, non-plausibly, deniably, has been supporting the Mujahideen all along, just like he did in Libya, and that's high treason. And he ought to go to prison for the rest of his life for that. There's just no question about that. But then again, he could have invaded Syria, or he could have done what John McCain would have had him do, full-scale bombing campaign, special forces, and whatever weapons the opposition needed to sack Damascus. And he didn't do that, at least. Now, it could be that the Republicans are just playing bad cop on that, but no, I don't think so. I think, you know, even Hillary and Petraeus, they really wanted to make the situation in Syria much worse than it's been. And, you know, none of this is an apology for Obama whatsoever. I can't think of a thing he's done good, really, except so far pursuing the nuclear deal. Although he could have had it years ago and sabotaged his own efforts 2-3 times over by now, so you can't give him that much credit even for that. But otherwise, he's been a catastrophe. He's escalated the wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan and Yemen and Somalia. He's done the wars and the regime change in Libya and half of one in Syria. So, yeah, no, he's absolutely horrible. But then, you know, when Bush invaded Iraq, he sent 300,000 men and left 100,000 there for years. Got a million people killed. Sided with some of the worst torturers against the other worst torturers on the other side. Sided with the Bottom Brigade against Al-Qaeda. And fought a giant civil war that accomplished nothing for America and you know, only bad guys gained out of it. On all sides. Up until and including this day. I don't know. Anyway, back to that stab in the back article in McClatchy DC earlier about how these guys, as far as they can tell, the only thing that ever happened wrong was that we ever left. That's the worst thing Obama ever did, was pull out, as George Carlin said, oh, no, that's not what a real man does. You gotta stay in there and F them until they're all dead. We left a few women and children alive in Vietnam, and we haven't felt good about ourselves since, he said. I think he characterized it just right, you know? Same thing here with Iraq. We can't cut and run, they chanted, from the beginning of the horrible catastrophic failure in 2003 all the way up through and until today. The lesson of what's happening in Iraq now is not that we shouldn't have gone. It's that we should have never, ever, ever left. According to those who gave their family members for this thing. If that's what you call it. I mean, the level of self-deception here is, I mean, to me, it's, I mean, whatever. I mean, if you actually have family who died in the thing, you got to tell yourself whatever you have to tell yourself. That's fine. I don't hold a grudge about that. But, you know, for the consensus in the town, for everyone to just, you know, pat themselves on the back, they did a wonderful thing by invading and overthrowing Iraq and fighting that war that whole time. And the problem now is that we ever left, if for that to be their conclusion, is sickening. I mean, it's, that is not justifiable at all. The American people don't have the right to spin that war in their own favor that way. Again, you know, I exempt you if your son died in the dang thing. You gotta tell yourself whatever you gotta tell yourself, I guess. But the rest of you, that is absolutely contemptible. You know, it's the same thing in Vietnam. Oh, we were just about to win the Vietnam War before Barack Obama pulled our guys out. Whatever, dude. It was Nixon that pulled the guys out. You know? But, oh, well. No, it was a damn liberal media and whatever. Well, what was the war? Do you know what the war was? The war was to keep the people of South Vietnam from choosing their own government, a government that would have wanted us to go. Allied with the government in the North that America was not really at war against. There, you know, I mean, yeah, they did incursions and they bombed the hell out of them from the air, but they never invaded North Vietnam to conquer and regime change North Vietnam. They're just fighting guerrillas in the South that were backed by the North and the Russians and the Chinese. In jungle territory for a decade straight, and made zero progress whatsoever at doing anything other than burning a bunch of people to death. And then when the Americans left, Saigon was gone. That was it. There was supposed to be some kind of year or two transition period or something. It took them 2 weeks. The Northern Vietnamese army just walked into the South and conquered the entire thing. Oh yeah, you were about to win it. And in truth, just like Ron Paul said, look, now we're friends with them. And just like Jacob Hornberger said, now we're even selling them weapons. We're incorporating them into the empire. And that's after the communists won. And this is how the Nazis came to power in Germany, of course. Was blaming Jews and Democrats and anyone who opposed them for stabbing the German people in the back and surrendering in World War I. Vengeance is theirs, they cried.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. darrenscoffee.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Jason Ditz and Phil Giraldi coming up. Ukraine and Iran and the Islamic State. I guess I'll ask Jason about Gaza, too. I don't know. I mean, it could be war with Russia. Maybe I'm a damn fool for paying attention to anything other than the Ukraine crisis today. This might be my last show because we all die in hydrogen fusion this weekend. Probably not. If there's one thing I've learned to count on, it's that Barack Obama always backs down. Now, it depends on who he backs down to. A lot of times he backs down to the war party and then does something absolutely horrible. In this case, I think, you know, we try to hope he backs down from America's aggression in Ukraine and let this thing cool back down again. Are you willing to trade your hometown? Everyone you've ever known or cared about in a war with the Russians over eastern Ukraine? Me either. And I actually have extended family there from the wife's side of the family. But by default, I absolutely care about those people and their fate for real. But, you know what? Sorry, it sucks for you that you live next to Russia. It's not my problem. It is my problem because my government is making it my problem. But, no, the truth of the matter is that Russia, no matter what school of foreign policy thought you come from, Russia has thousands of H-bombs, and that means that they are independent from the United States, as long as they mean to be. And there ain't a damn thing we can do about that, and we have to respect that fact. We cannot defeat, dismember, subjugate Russia, because they will go to war first. So that's it. There's your red line. They are independent. You cannot take their independence away. You're never going to have a drunken ass Boris Yeltsin again in there to do American bidding. Not in this dimension anyway. Not for a long, long time. Not till who knows what happens. But as a result of this policy, no. And everything they're doing to surround Ukraine, I mean, to surround Russia, to move their bases east and all of this, all they're doing is picking a fight. You know, I talked with Sheldon Richman this morning, and we kind of had a, you know, we had a conversation about what Mearsheimer said on the show last week. I says to Mearsheimer, I says, well, what about the interests? And what about NATO expansion as, you know, the continued Cold War with Russia, you know, that kind of thing? And he just said, no, that has nothing to do with it. Poland is just trying to create basically a free trade zone. NATO is just sort of the extra security on the expanded European community we're creating here. It's the future of mankind, free markets and democracy. So that's all. And it didn't necessarily, I guess in his telling, it didn't necessarily include or exclude Russia because it wasn't about Russia. It's just about building up Western institutions for the long haul. For a while in the late 90s, they talked about bringing Russia into NATO. In fact, Vladimir Zhirinovsky, the right-wing nationalist, talked about bringing them into NATO and going to war against Islamic South Asia together. You know, I don't know. Sure seems like a great many in American foreign policy did have designs on breaking up Russia, doing everything they can to weaken Russia. If you listen to that interview I keep playing with the editor of Foreign Affairs talking about Ukraine on the Colbert Report, he clearly says, you know, we're trying to that Ukraine is Robin to Russia's Batman. And what we're trying to do is run off with them. We're trying to take that country away from Russia's sphere of influence and into ours. And they have spoken in the recent past, in the Bush administration at least, about bringing Ukraine and Georgia into NATO, which is not just a fun acronym. Freudian slip there, only I mispronounced my damn Freudian slip because that's what a dumbass I am. But anyway, that acronym, anachronism, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization is basically, it's a war guarantee. If Ukraine was in NATO, that would mean NATO could put bases in Ukraine, put their nuclear missiles right on Russia's border, not on the Soviet Union's borders, but right on Russia's border there. And if Russia ever tried to do anything about it, the U.S. would be bound by treaty to intervene on Ukraine's behalf. That's why it's madness to bring the Baltic states into NATO, any of this NATO expansion, even if you assume keeping NATO at the end of the Cold War, which I don't, but even if you assume that, expanding it all the way up to Russia's borders, what you're saying is if some, you know, Putin times two gets in there and is a real jerk and decides he does want to reclaim some of their near abroad, that means that for towns in Latvia and Estonia you've never heard of, you've got to give up Austin, Texas, or Bangor, Maine, or wherever the hell you're from. Does that sound fair to you? Does that sound right to you that America... And in fact, what that means is, if some wannabe George W. Bush or Barack Obama comes to power in Estonia, and he picks a fight with the Russians, we are bound to go and... We've basically outsourced our decision to go to war with Russia to them, not just to the Russians, for things that they might do to countries that have really nothing to do with us, but even outsourcing our decisions to those countries, whether they want to declare war for us. And, I mean, it all sounds very far out. Who could be so stuck in any mindset that they would actually get the world into a nuclear war? You know what? These things happen. In fact, see, I'm kind of scared that what Mearsheimer said is true. And I was talking about this with Sheldon. You know, and I put this to, I think, Robert Mary, or Mary or Perry, one of these guys from foreignpolicy.com, a real old graybeard foreign policy realist type. And I said, listen, I'm oversimplifying and everything, but only so you can set me straight and help me understand. But isn't it the case that these foreign policy philosophies are very connected to these different interests? Like, say, for example, the bankers like the liberal internationalists and the oil men sponsor the realists, and the military-industrial complex and the Israel lobby sponsor the right-wing nationalists and the neoconservatives. And so the, you know, academic note about why it is we have to do all these things is really serving the interests of these various groups who get what, you know, their end out of the empire. And what he said to me was something along the lines of, I have no idea what you're talking about. I've never even heard that before. You know, like, who's bankrolled the existence of the Council on Foreign Relations all this time or anything like that? Nah, you know, it's simply academic. And my fear is that actually then that means that people with real interests don't really, in a way, don't have a say. That actually you can have people with just real dumb ideas and there's not enough market force within the establishment power structure to necessarily, you know, veto and strike them down. In other words, we might be better off with the skull and bones in charge than maybe someone would be smart enough to say no to some of these plans sometimes. But instead, it's just a free-for-all. So if Robert Kagan, Bill Kristol's little lick spittle, can put his wife, Dick Cheney's former Eastern European advisor, into Obama's State Department, and she can foment a coup d'etat in Ukraine, then who's going to stop him? Who's there to stop him? He's got an idea. No, I mean, it is the interest. And yes, I oversimplify, but yes, no, it is about interest. But to hear Mearsheimer say, huh, is really, to me, I think, a window into the thinking of the academics who come up with the window dressing for the interest. They really believe their own kind of way of looking at things. I mean, I don't know. I should have followed up. Like, come on. The neocons represent the interests of Israel, not just, you know, end of history, Francis Fukuyama, you know, idealism or something. They represent what the Likud party wants, right? Lockheed sponsored the committee to expand NATO. Lockheed sponsored the committee for the liberation of Iraq. Those aren't just ideas, are they? Are they? Jason Ditz and Phil Giraldi coming up. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, guys. Welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Well, I'm relieved to see that Ukraine is not the top headline right now. That would be bad news. Syria's still got the top slot for worst thing today. Antiwar.com. Whew. That's a little bit of a relief. But then again, I don't like the sound of this at all. The top Ukraine headline does say, East Ukraine war escalates. Rebels seize key port. Welcome back to the show, Jason Ditz. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us here again today. News.antiwar.com. That's where Jason Ditz writes. He's the news editor there at antiwar.com. East Ukraine war escalates. Rebels seize key port. Please tell us everything you know, Jason.
Well, unfortunately, it's not all that clear what's happening today. There's a lot of rumors of a Russian invasion. NATO's saying that they have satellite footage of 1,000 Russian troops somewhere around the Ukrainian border. Exactly where somewhere is, we're not really sure. The city of Novoazovsk, which fell yesterday to the rebels. Now they're reporting Russia took it over, which doesn't seem to be backed up by anything other than Ukrainian allegations.
And so now, as far as, what is the Russian government admitted to or confirmed as far as these accusations go?
Well, Russia is saying they didn't do anything. They're saying there is no invasion going on, nothing of the sort's happening, and that there aren't Russian troops in the Ukraine fighting.
I had seen some headlines. I'm sorry, I don't have them here, but I had seen some headlines claiming that the Russians are conceding, at least some of this or something, but the answer to that is still no.
Right. The most recent statements from Russian ambassadors to the European Union, Russia's OSCE rep, they're all saying that this is just complete nonsense. They're saying other than those 10 Russian troops that strayed across the border the other day that got captured by Ukraine, there are no troops in Ukraine right now.
And then, now, what are those guys? Because when we talked yesterday, I don't know if you had seen the video before that. I was only just watching the video right there during the interview where at least the subtitles say that, yeah, I knew we were on our way to Ukraine, that kind of thing. Was there any explanation as to why there were 10 guys there? Maybe they were special forces guys who were going to help lead the rebels in some way or another, or it really did seem like just a mistake?
It's really not clear at this point. The interviews, or the confession video, certainly makes it sound like they were special forces, which is the official Ukrainian narrative. but it's not clear exactly who these guys were, what they were doing that close to the border to begin with. Were they just, you know, border patrol type people or what? We really don't know.
All right. Well, so I don't know, man. You know, part of the problem here, you and I have the same problem as everybody else, is this is a long way from here, and there's not very much good reporting coming out of there. There's a hell of a lot of what people would have us believe coming out of there, and in all angles of analysis of the situation as well. And so in these kind of circumstances, the war party and their echo chamber, they get to push pretty much whatever they want. I mean, on Twitter today, at least among the right-wingers that I follow, well, and the neocons, you know, their whole thing is, oh my God, the Russians are invading and Obama's doing nothing about it, of course, because of what a feckless Jimmy Carter he is, et cetera, et cetera. And there's really no one to contradict them with the facts because no one else really has any. They get to fill up the vacuum with their narrative.
Right, and right now their narrative is pretty much just whatever Ukraine happens to say at the time, whether it makes sense or not. The interesting thing, I think, is a lot of the media reporting, AP articles and things like that, the photographs associated with those reports of Russian tank columns rolling in Ukraine and things like that, the photos they show are not even Russian tanks. They're showing stock photos of Ukrainian tanks in cities that aren't even where the fighting is supposedly taking place. So they're just whatever fits the situation. Nobody has any good photos that prove what they're saying is happening.
Well, then I guess the question is whether this thing escalates along the lines of the narrative at all, or whether really these idiots can say whatever they want because the facts on the ground aren't really changing, so the war really isn't escalating any different than it was the day before yesterday.
Well, I mean, it's not clear, but it certainly doesn't seem like it. It seems like the primary things that are happening today are the European Union, some of their nations are using this alleged invasion as an excuse to push more sanctions. The stock market's taking a hit as in Europe and in Russia on speculation that this invasion might have happened, but it doesn't seem like on the ground there's all that much evidence that anything's happening.
Yeah. You know, when it comes to the American and the Ukrainian side of this narrative, in my mind, the strongest thing they have going for them is that they have lied so much that it's almost unbelievable that they would continue to tell such blatant, disprovable lies. That, you know, at some point, the boy who cried wolf has got to be right. I mean, they can only get away with so much without at least possibly provoking the Russians into making them stop or something, you know? So, I mean, I don't know. And because they're pretty big lies. Giant armored columns, huh? So that either happened or it didn't, and a narrative like that cannot stand for very long without them having to take it back before they try again, you know, in another few days, I guess. But
right, and we saw that before with the last armored column that Russia supposedly sent and that Ukraine supposedly wiped out and then turned out not to have even happened. But it seems like they're just they're pushing these narratives without providing any evidence. And NATO, I think, has their fingers crossed because this would be a great excuse for their plans to send more troops to Eastern Europe. Mm-hmm. And they're figuring a broken clock is right twice a day. So maybe this will be the one time when Ukraine says something that's actually true.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, so the Americans, I mean, and the Europeans, I guess, caught up with American policy here, seem to be determined to really, I don't know, how much damage do you think they're really trying to do to the Russian economy? They're trying to really break it? Or do they have the ability? I mean, aren't they so dependent on Russian oil and gas that they just, you know, basically they can talk tough, but otherwise they got to continue to cooperate, don't they?
Right. That's the problem here all along. This is not 1979 Iran that you're talking about, where its connections to the world are, you know, basically some oil exports and that's about it. This is a 21st century connected economy that's intimately tied with the rest of Europe, and trying to cut it off, I mean, yeah, in theory, the European Union could probably break the Russian economy, but they couldn't do it without breaking the German economy, breaking the Austrian economy, breaking the economies of pretty much all of Eastern Europe.
I could see them thinking, you know, like chemotherapy, it's worth it to take a hit because they'll take it harder than we will, but it's just like in Syria. Really, who do you think is going to be better than the guys that are in charge now, you know?
Right, and David Cameron, the British Prime Minister, has actually made that argument publicly that we're willing to take the hit if it means hitting them back. But and it would certainly hurt investment in London because London's is pretty heavily linked to the European economy. But the damage that complete sanctions on Russia would do to Britain are pretty small compared to what it would do to much of the rest of Europe. So I don't think everyone else is necessarily on board for that.
Right. Yeah, well, I wonder if the British are taking that into account or not. You know, Mearsheimer the other day said he wasn't seeing any daylight between America and Germany on this at all, which I thought I'd seen some. I guess I'll ask you what you think of that on the other side of this break. It's Jason Ditz from news.antiwar.com.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future of Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
Hey, everybody, I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Got a small pile of silver I'm sending out in the mail this afternoon. Anybody donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show, you get a 1 ounce silver QR code commodity disc that tells you its spot price in real time. CommodityDiscs.com. ScottHorton.org/donate. All right. I'm talking with Jason Ditz about the situation in Ukraine. He's the news editor at antiwar.com. That's news.antiwar.com. In fact, I think here in a minute I'm going to start asking you some Afghanistan questions and other things too, Jason. But more on Ukraine here. Another big, phony, trumped up bunch of headlines about a Russian invasion. It still ain't true. 10 guys crossed the border. No one really knows exactly what they were doing. But as far as all this stuff about armored columns, et cetera, you're telling me these claims have evaporated, just another narrative, and we're still where we were 2-3 days ago. Is that correct?
It seems like it. I mean, like I say, what we don't know about what's going on in eastern Ukraine could fill an awful lot more time than what we do know. But sure, there's certainly no evidence that any of these new allegations are true. So in the absence of that, it seems like we're still at the same situation we were yesterday or the day before.
Yeah. Still waiting for a reason to believe. All right. And you know, at this point, it really is a boy who cried wolf situation. They've been saying that Russia's on the verge of invading eastern Ukraine at least for 8 months now. So I guess it'll catch us by surprise if it ever becomes true.
Yeah. And I think that's what NATO was kind of counting on, that sooner or later they'd be right on this. But after months and months, it's starting to look like maybe they're not right on this.
I wonder if he's ever actually just sent them a letter, Putin, that says, hey, no, really, seriously, man, you guys can knock it off now. I'm not coming. You know, I think he probably has. All right, so now, well, let's go back to where we were right before the break there about U.S. and Germany. I had thought, and we talked about this somewhat, about how the Germans, I thought on two different occasions here at the end of June and then just a couple of weeks ago, that they'd really been trying, or at least reportedly had been trying, to get the Kiev government to really work this out, and then America keeps encouraging them to be intransigent and keep fighting anyway, kind of a thing. Mearsheimer hadn't apparently ever heard of any of that. He didn't know what I was talking about. He said he's searching in vain for a sign of really any discrepancy between America and Germany's policy here, regardless of how different our interests are in this matter, where America does not import a bunch of oil and gas from Russia But the Germans very much do, you know?
Yeah, well, there's a pretty big disconnect between what the Merkel government is saying publicly and what we're hearing reports from German officials saying is going on behind the scenes. The grand bargain that Germany was pushing was never publicly announced as a German policy. It was sort of something that they were trying to get going on the table at the talks. But publicly, yeah, they really haven't offered any sort of indication that they're any different from the U.S. on their position on Russia.
Yeah. All right. And then, so now, fill us in as much as you can about this story of the port, the rebels seizing the port. I think you said they did take it, but then they left, or did that even pan out?
Well, it's not clear. Last night it was reported they took the port. The rebels took the port, which... And then this morning, we hear that there's fighting at the port, and it's Russia and the Ukrainian military, and that the rebels aren't there. So, whether this is an indication that the rebels left, or whether they're fighting the rebels and just calling them Russia for the sake of the narrative, I don't know.
Hmm. And now, I'm looking at Google Maps now, trying to figure out where exactly this is. This is in the south of the Donetsk region?
Yeah, it's basically the first city on the southeast, if you follow the Sea of Azov along the coast next to Russia. If you follow the road in from Russia, it's the first town you get to.
I see.
Which is probably why the rebels would want it, because it gives them another link to Russia, as opposed to the Ukrainian narrative, which is that this is part of some sort of plot to take the entire 120-mile stretch from the Russian border to Crimea and create a land route to Crimea, which seems like an incredibly ambitious plan that I don't think there's any evidence to support, and certainly not something the rebels could probably pull off.
Right. All right. Man, the clock ticks fast on this show. Talk to me a little bit about Abdullah Abdullah in Afghanistan and the runoff that never ends and the future of the presidency there.
Well, right now the talk is that we're going to have an end to the audit on September 10th. So 8 days after when the inauguration is supposed to take place. Both sides have withdrawn all their observers from the audit now. Abdullah, because he says the audit process is corrupt and they're not counting fairly. And on the Ghani side, they withdrew because the UN asked them to for some reason. Now, why the UN wanted them to withdraw too, I don't know. But now it seems like there are no observers at all for the audit, and it's just sort of... going through the motions.
That's interesting. So, but who's doing the audit?
The Afghan Independent Election Commission, which is the same group that Abdullah issued audio tapes from early on in the audit process, showing that one of their leaders was ordering them to stuff ballots on behalf of Ghani.
Mm-hmm. Of course, Abdullah Abdullah was the CIA's choice when they tried to regime change Karzai in 2009, and it didn't work out, and they were stuck with him again anyway. He stole the election better than they could, I guess. But anyway, dang, I forgot what I was just going to ask you about that.
Well,
I know what I was going to ask you. This guy and his opposition, Ghani, they're both equally CIA stooges as far as you can tell, or not?
Yeah, as far as we can tell, Ghani's more closely connected with the Karzai government than Abdullah is, so that's sort of given him the advantage in ballot stuffing.
Mm-hmm. But is it just a matter of one is a front man for Dostum and the other is a front man for Hekmatyar or some kind of madness like that, or more
well,
to it than that?
It's more of an ethnic division right now, because Ghani is a Pashtun, whereas Abdullah is half Pashtun, half Tajik. So a lot of the Pashtuns don't like the idea of someone that's only half Pashtun running the country. Mm. And that's what's dominating the Karzai cabinet right now.
Mm. All right, well, we'll have to stop it right there. Music's playing, we got to go. But thanks very much for your time again, Jason. I appreciate it.
Sure, thanks for having me.
All right, y'all, that's the great Jason Ditz, news.antiwar.com. Hey, y'all, Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. All right, next up, it's our friend Phil Giraldi again. He's writing at UNZ.com. That's UNZ, UNZ.com. At the American Conservative Magazine. And Phil, we got a lot of background noise there. And he's also at the Council for the National Interest. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. This one is at UNZ.com. Billionaires make war on Iran. Oh, yeah, he's also a former CIA and former DIA officer as well. I meant to say that. Hey, welcome back. How are you doing, Phil?
I'm fine, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing good. You know, I was just thinking during the break there on while you were sitting on hold that, as is often relevant on this show, you're the one who broke the story back in December of 2011 that in the American Conservative Magazine and then also shortly thereafter in a follow-up for antiwar.com that Obama had signed these new findings authorizing covert action against Iran and Syria. And right when it just makes no sense whatsoever from an American point of view for us to be siding with Mujahideen rebels against the Iranians when never even mind that Iran isn't really our enemy and these Mujahideen guys are cousins of the September 11th hijackers and all of that, but Obama even has a policy of trying to make peace with the Iranians by passing this damn nuclear deal. And then here he is, you know, of course, on keeping America on both sides of the regional civil war going on here. So what's it all about, Phil?
Well, I think you summed it up, Scott. It's not about anything logical. I mean, the right from the beginning, this whole concept that we were going to be supporting insurgents, which nearly from day one were perceived at least as being part highly radical, was a stupid policy. As in the case of Saddam Hussein, Assad is not any poster boy for anything. But at the same time, if you're worried about this, you know, what happens to minorities in these countries, and what the U.S. strategic interests are, you support the guy that gives you stability and is not out slaughtering his own people. And you know, it's just like it was totally insane, this policy, right from the beginning. And now we're the fruit of it has come home. I don't know what they're going to do. I mean, the logical thing now to do is to team up with Iraq, with Iran, and with Syria to get rid of these guys. But that's not going to happen. Francois Hollande already announced today that he and the rest of the West would not be dealing with Syria. I mean, what are they, crazy? I mean, you know, if you consider ISIS to be as serious a threat as our government officials have been saying, then you do what you have to do. And I just don't get it anymore. It's like it's insanity has taken over the White House.
Well, I'm reading in the Associated Press where they're saying, you know, we would hate to give Assad any advantage here, so we're going to bomb Assad targets, Syrian state targets, at the same time as we target ISIS in eastern and northern Syria.
Yeah, I saw that. I was thinking, you know, my God, can it get any crazier? You know, if the United States really has an interest in doing something about ISIS, then you do something about ISIS, and you do whatever you have to do it. And I think for a fact that the ISIS threat has been way overinflated. But the fact is, this is a nasty group of people who are carrying out atrocities. And so if we feel because we triggered this whole protest by invading Iraq, which is true, and we have some responsibility for trying to straighten it out. Then you have to work with the parties that are local, because the United States can't do it. It doesn't know how to do it. Every time it goes into one of these situations, it just makes everything worse.
Yeah. Although, I mean, a big part of the problem here is all our intervention in Iraq ultimately was on the side of these Iranian-backed parties, as we've discussed all this time, 9 years running now, Phil. And so, like you're saying, if you're going to ally with those who have the ability to really defeat these guys, that means Iran, the Shiite Baghdad government that Bush put in there, and Assad. But then that just makes matters that much worse with these guys and, you know, dealing with the aftermath of that, because it just makes it just puts America back on the side of the Shiites and the Iranians in the regional civil war, maybe to no good end other than dispersing these ISIS guys to the wind where they're going to blow back here. Even worse than before.
Yeah, it's everything becomes worse. That's the whole, you know, crisis in what's happened in the last 10 years. It was basically you started with a situation where we were, without a doubt, attacked, but we suddenly lashed out at people that had nothing to do with it. We went into Afghanistan to get rid of the bad guys, which we did in fairly short order, and then we decided to stay for 10 years. You know, it's like, Who is designing these policies? What are they thinking? And if guys like you and me, who are not in the loop, really can figure these things out, why can't they figure it out?
Well, it's because of their, first of all, their narrow vision, but also their vested interests, right? I mean, well, let me ask you this way. What was the CIA guys that you were talking to, whoever they were, whatever agency they were part of, Phil, who told you that Obama had signed this new finding back in 2011? Did they pass word about whether they objected or that they were concerned that this was going to be a problem or not? I mean, I did read a quote. Patrick Coburn said that he talked to a high-level American official in 2012 and said to him the same thing Coburn's been telling me on this show and this audience all along, is that the Iraqi government officials, the Shiite government officials, are terrified that our support for the civil war in Syria is going to blow back bad on them and is already destabilizing the Sunni areas of Iraq. And that this official told Patrick Coburn, yeah, no, we're not worried about that this is going to become a problem in Iraq. But I just wonder, what about the professional analyst types, the ones who are being actually ordered to do this? They had to have known better. I mean, Lou Rockwell said on this show back in 2005 or something, look at these lunatic neocons. They want to target Syria, the last place in the Middle East you can get a drink? Really? Is that what makes sense here? After what's already happened in Iraq?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. I mean, it's just that, you know, and when I talk with, admittedly, most of the people I talk to are retired agency people who still have connections. They still talk to people inside. That's kind of the nature of the beast. But the fact is, you know, I don't know a single former officer. I'm talking about like Paul Pillar, Ray McGovern, people that I know you talk to also, who think this makes any sense. And I would bet the people inside the building who are working on this thing probably believe the same thing, but their jobs are on the line, you see? And that's the way it works. If some guy on the seventh floor, which is the leadership floor at CIA, decides that, you know, the president's doing a great job and we have to support him on this, it goes all the way down the line and everybody's got to support him on this. And occasionally you'll get a rebellion by analysts. I've written about a couple of them where analysts just refuse to, as in the Iran threat reports, the two NIEs. Mm-hmm. The analysts refused to go along with basically saying that Iran had a nuclear program. And so it does happen, but the general thrust of things is that you've got to go with the flow because you're part of an organization and you want to get promoted.
Yeah. Well, and the CIA, of course, as an agency, has gone along with this whole project all along. It's their job to do it, and they have been. But at least, you know, another example of the rebellion, as you reported a year ago, was the almost attack a year ago, where they had to put out, the White House had to put out a government assessment because the CIA refused to vouch for the accusation that Assad had done the gas attack.
That's
pretext,
right.
We were going to be Al-Qaeda's Air Force and bomb Assad a year ago.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But that, you know, the system is corrupted. I mean, let's just accept that. And basically, we have people in Washington running these things that are constantly looking over their shoulders about, you know, who is saying what about them, what kind of pressure groups are piling up against them, and so on and so forth. We don't have any sensible policies. All we have is government in terms of response to intimidation.
Right.
And that's what goes on in Washington.
Well, and that's the other side of this break. Billionaires make war on Iran. Exact opposite of what we need in just a sec, y'all. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Phil Giraldi, former CIA officer. Now he writes for the American Conservative Magazine and for UNZ.com. That's UNZ, UNZ.com. This one is called Billionaires Make War on Iran. At a time... I guess it all waxes and wanes back and forth around here, depending on American policy and other factors. But at a time where right now Iran's deadly enemies in the Islamic State are the major crisis, there are some billionaires in America who are determined to take out all their wrath on Iran no matter what. And so what billionaires? What's it all about, Phil?
Well, this is, you know, the usual suspects. I mean, Sheldon Adelson and people like that, who are essentially very closely tied to the Israel lobby in various aspects, AIPAC, and this organization that I focused on for this story is the United Against Nuclear Iran, which is a smaller group that most of us have probably not heard of. But the interesting fact is that they're involved in a lawsuit in New York City right now, and they're being sued by a Greek billionaire who's also Jewish, and this guy essentially is claiming that they defamed him last year. They outed him, saying that he was illegally trading with Iran because they had business reasons to do that. They were competitors, and so he's claiming that. But the interesting aspect for me is that the U.S. government is trying to squash this whole lawsuit because this group, United Against Nuclear Iran, apparently has a lot of classified information. And if you kind of think your way through it, the classified information must be Treasury Department and Justice Department investigations of Americans and other people for suspicion of breaking sanctions with Iran. So these are classified documents that are being given to a private entity that wants war with Iran, and these documents are being used to make their case. So I think it's quite incredible.
Yeah, well, of course, that's what the Trading with the Enemy Act is all about in the first place, right? Is not just punishment if you do so. It's a licensing procedure so that you may trade with the enemy if you're in on it with the Treasury, but you're not allowed to go outside the lines. That's the deal.
Yeah, that's right.
Especially if your competition is better connected than you are.
Yeah, well, these guys are well connected. That's clearly the case. And essentially, whether the case that this guy was specifically defamed for business reasons or not turns out to be true, I don't know. But if you read all the details of the article that appeared in the New York Times, you would see that he has a pretty plausible case. But as I say, to me, the amazing thing is the U.S. government collaboration with a group like this, mm-hmm. while our president is claiming he wants to negotiate a peace deal with Iran, at the same time, they're feeding information to an organization which is going in the opposite direction. So it's quite amazing.
Right. Yeah, well, all these policies, very contradictory. And now, you know, I don't know. Well, let me ask you, where do you stand on the chances for a final nuclear deal at this point, Phil? Because, in fact, earlier you reported that they had a pretty damn good deal worked out in Oman in the background while the rest of these clowns are parading around in front of the cameras, that the actual professionals, you know, had a handshake going here.
Yeah, well, you know, everybody knows what the deal would be. Iran has to have limited capability to enrich uranium with an inspections regime, and so on and so forth. Everybody knows what the deal is. But the fact is, every time we're very close to a deal, these pressure groups, and the United States in particular, and the Israeli government, put pressure on the White House, and we kind of back off a little bit from it. And that's what's happening. My feeling is it ain't going to happen. There are more things that can go wrong that can go right on this. I know you talk to Gareth Porter occasionally. Gareth is the real expert on this. I mean, he's got sources and he's really into the issue, and he sort of feels it's all a lot of theater going on now, and it will happen. But I'm not so sure about that.
Yeah. Well, and he's only just very recently switched to optimist on this, because it was after the Ayatollah gave a speech where he said, yeah, one day we'll have 90,000 centrifuges. And instead of latching onto that and flipping out, Kerry said, yeah, we know that that's not really what they mean and that kind of thing. We're going to keep talking anyway. And how that was really to him the biggest indication that, oh, wow, they're not using that as a cheap excuse. And of course, the Ayatollah is talking about decades from now in some totally different context, not, you know, anything near term, not anything contrary to the deal that they're working out now.
That's right. Yeah.
But that very well could have been a really bad talking point. You know what I mean? The way he said it.
Yeah, well, Gareth is kind of my expert on this because he really is close to the issue, and knows what he's talking about. But I'm pessimistic. I just see, you know, the fact that this keeps dragging out, and as it's dragging out, the people who are against this gain momentum, because they constantly are saying the same thing, that Iran is a threat, that, you know, and they pursue the same line. And if you repeat it often enough, it becomes like it's a dogma. Mm-hmm. And so I have a bad feeling about it.
Well, you know, did you see the article on AIPAC in The New Yorker the other day?
Yeah, I did. Mm-hmm.
Because,
right.
You know, there's a lot of that, a lot of sort of, I mean, I don't know how true this is, but a lot of spin about just how unprecedented it is for the Prime Minister of Israel to work so contrary to the interests of the U.S., or at least, you know, I'm sure he would argue... the U.S., this particular president and his particular policies, where people are saying, you know, his advisors are telling him, man, you better back down. He's just saying, no, he's going to do everything he can to stop America from making this deal. So then I guess in D.C., everybody who prefers Netanyahu to Obama, which is apparently a lot of people, they just fall in line behind that. If he has the chutzpah, then they do too.
Yeah, it's you know, it's like we're living in an age where the truth no longer resonates, because it doesn't exist anymore. I'm doing a piece right now on ISIS, and some of the comments coming out of John McCain, Lindsey Graham, that clown from New York State, Peter King. I mean, this stuff is incredible. These people are so ill-informed and so stupid that you wonder how they could get elected anything beyond dog catcher, and I certainly wouldn't even want to give them that job. Yeah. You know, it's absolutely astonishing. I mean, we have clowns running our government, people who could care less about what happens to the country and what happens to the American people. And it's just, is there going to be a revolution next year? I hope so. I mean, this is how much longer can this go on?
Yeah. Well, you know, Bill Moyers, who I disagree with on a hell of a lot of things, LBJ-style Democrat, I remember he said, you know, it used to be that there were always delusional types on all kinds of sides, not just both sides, but they were marginal. And now the delusional are at the center of the debate. They're leading it. And people who are grounded in any kind of reason or factual basis or historical context are, you know, basically just crying in the wind.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the crazy has become the new normal, and it's you know, it's not partisan. It's Republican and Democrat. I mean, the Republicans admittedly come out with the really crazy stuff, but so what? I mean, they're basically all on the same page when it comes to the foreign policy, and comes even to a lot of domestic policies. That I mean, how can anyone figure out immigration? You know, you have to reform the immigration program because it's killing us. You know, it's anyway, that's a sidebar.
No, you're right. I mean, there's a million of them, no doubt about that. And well, so now back to the Islamic State then for a minute, and all of the different competing interests there. I'm still predicting the worst. the more Obama says no ground troops and keeps sending special forces, the more I think he's going to end up sending the Marine Corps. I don't think it'll even wait for Hillary to do. And not that I want that, but I just can't see any other way around it from the government's point of view at this point. But I wonder what you think about that.
I kind of agree with you. I think they have this kind of way of doing things, and then they wait a while, and you don't hear anything, and you assume everything is okay, and then you suddenly realize, hey, we've got 400 ground troops in Iraq. As part of this article I'm doing on ISIS, I'm drawing comparisons with Boko Haram in Africa. Mm-hmm. We've got 600 advisors there. And nobody even talks about them, and we've had zero success in liberating any of those poor schoolgirls that were kidnapped. And you know, it's like, who is thinking these things through, and how do they keep getting away with it?
Yeah, well, all they need is just the slimmest pretext, and then it doesn't matter how bad it gets, because the worse it gets, the more excuse for more intervention they got. They can just keep going until they got a base, a lily pad here, there, and everywhere in every county on the planet.
That's right. That's right.
Except that we can't afford that. So it's kind of a race to see what blows up first, the economy or the nukes at this point.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. Phil Giraldi, everybody. UNS.com. Thanks, Phil.
Thanks, Scott.
See y'all Tuesday.